determine who, if anyone, is delaying the case. And imposing prejudgment interest as a discretionary matter.
I'd like to speak to that, if I may. First of all, it puts a real impossible burden on the judge because the judge can't tell from looking at the file who's delaying it. To know what is holding up a case, you have to, first of all, know what the case is about. And the judge looks at the pleadings, and he knows that there's 25 motions filed against a complaint, but he doesn't know whether there's any good reason for those 25 motions. By the same token, he looks at the case. He doesn't know whether that claim ultimately is supported by really strong evidence or whether it has no evidence to support it at all. And in order to make a determination that it either is or isn't being delayed, he'd have to know those things, which become very difficult for him to know. I suggest to you that the prejudgment interest is an automatic device because it relates back to the date the claim is filed by this section. If the case is no good, it'll never come into being anyway. And if the case is valid and good, it'll go back to the date it was filed and increase the amount of damages by at least the interest rate, you see. One final thing. There is absolutely plaintiffs work on a contingent fee basis. We don't get paid until we get the money in our hand. If we don't get any money, we don't get any salary. Now, you tell me why we would want to stall a case. We enjoy starvation. That's all we'd be getting for it. If I don't process cases through to a completion and put some money in my client's pocket, I don't have anything to spend. And so I have no incentive, none at all, to hold up a case. On the other hand, an insurance company that's got the reserves that are earning tax-free interest perhaps does have. I categorically say to you, no plaintiff in his right mind is going to make a living by stalling his cases. He's simply going to starve. He doesn't get paid.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, something just occurred to me. There's a statute somewhere in the 20s that says in cases involving, I think it's up to it's a low amount, $5,000 or $10,000, that there's an offer made.
28080.
28080, all right.
20080.
20.080.
$4,000.
How much?
$4,000.
$4,000. Now, we've got a statute right now. It seems to me that maybe we ought to increase the amount in the statute. The statute that I'm thinking of says that if there's a written offer of settlement made, and it's rejected, and you go to trial, and you don't obtain a verdict in excess of that offer, then even though you win the case, you've got to pay the cost. You can't collect costs from the other party, and you've got to pay the other party's costs. I'm just wondering, maybe Senator Hill, if at some point we might consider making that statute effective without limit. That is, it could apply as well in a $100,000 case as a $5,000 case.
If I'm not mistaken, Mr. Chairman, first off, that's 20.080 is not the one you're talking about now. I think Senator Wires and I both thought you were talking about the statute that says you get interest on a small claim if you've made a demand and if the plaintiff's made a demand and it hasn't been met within 10 days.
No, that's not the one.
I think the one you're talking about is the tender into court provision.
Right.
Offer of compromise into court. Now, if I'm not mistaken, that statute only works to the defendant's benefit.
Right. It only works toward the defendant.
Well,
all that does is say if the defendant tenders a particular offer into court and then the plaintiff doesn't exceed it by their verdict, then the defendant is entitled to their cost.
That's right. That's the one I'm thinking of. Well,
I was thinking.
Well, I'm going to ask staff to get that thing out, and I think we ought to put that on the table and take a look at it and see if that's not something else that we can do that would encourage settlement.
Senator, that's a voluntary thing on the part of the defendant now to make that offer a compromise,
right.
And it's not admissible in trial, but it's just something that could be used as a tool.
And it doesn't work as an incentive against the defendant to make them speed up if the incentives, economic incentives, are slowing them down.
Well, let me just ask you, as long as we're talking about it, now suppose we took that statute and changed it around so that in every case, either the defendant could make an offer or the plaintiff could make a demand, and then if the verdict was less in the one instance there, then the offer then the plaintiff would not be able to recover costs but would pay costs. And on the other hand, either party could recover costs from the other party if either the demand or the offer. If the verdict was inconsistent.
If you look at Section 8, I think Section 8 effectively does that. It doesn't say cost, it says interest. But I think Section 8 essentially gives the other side. You know, we have a non-reciprocal situation now where the defendant can get the benefit of having proposed a settlement if the plaintiff doesn't exceed it. What this says is that if the plaintiff proposes a settlement and the defendant doesn't meet it, and the plaintiff meets or exceeds it, then the plaintiff gets the benefit of the interest.
Well, right. I mean, that's right. But I think there may be a little problem on handling this through prejudgment interest. I'm trying to think of another way to handle it, and I'm thinking of... Pardon?
Isn't it the same thing? We're talking about the same thing.
Yeah. I'm talking about the costs.
Oh, okay. You can do costs and expenses and list them out.
Senator Frey, could I mention some of that, Lyle Vler? When you're talking about costs, of course, you have to understand what costs are. And insurance companies usually are perfectly willing to gamble cost bill. In my defense days, we used it for one insurance company. They always had us do it. And I think it's in Section 30. I'm not too sure if it's in 30 or Section 20.
So you're saying it's not much of an incentive?
I don't think it's any incentive at all. I only had one insurance company out of 30 or 40 that I worked with during that period of time who used it at all. I think prejudgment interest is a much more effective way towards consideration of that rather than this offer of compromise statute, which is rarely used. I think in the last 6 years that I've been plaintiffing cases, I think I've seen it used two or three times is all. And usually it's at the insistence of some company that some guy in Philadelphia has read about it. Most of the Oregon companies don't even pay attention to it.
Just Charles Bird again. That is a little misleading, too, because if you have the defendant making an offer and the plaintiff doesn't accept it, thereby invoking the cost to the defendant, if the plaintiff still gets a verdict, the plaintiff also gets costs with the verdict. So what you're doing is you're just trading costs. And it really has a very little effect because of that. If you don't get any verdict at all, of course, the defendant gets costs anyway, you see.
Oh, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wires.
Following up just briefly, I hope, on Senator Hill's question. There was a professor that spoke at the CLE on litigation. Up at Rippling River, I believe, and it was a professor here at Willamette. I should have dug this out before I started asking my question, but one of the defense lawyers witnessed yesterday distributed something he'd written and which he'd done a study and found that the delays were more caused by the plaintiff than by the defense, and I wonder if you've read that. I think that's part of what Senator Hill was asking about.
I confess I haven't read it, but I doubt that he's tried very many cases. It's patently obvious if you look at any... We're going through a thing now called a paper chase. Since the court rules were drastically amended to provide for mandatory discovery, files that used to be 300 pages thick are now 2,000 pages thick. And we have a lot of them. Their computer spits out requests for admissions and interrogatories and requests for production, and my computer spits back answers. And it's come to that. And the system's getting clogged up with it. But that's not a delay. That's just simply because the court rules changed in the effort to make it more of a discoverable area. We've allowed multitudes of paperwork, which never was a part of the system before. I go back and look at my files 10 years ago and marvel at how thin they are compared to what they are now. Some of them occupy a complete file drawer on a case that in years gone by you never heard of such a thing. But it's also unique that you get 25 and 30 Rule 21 motions to a single complaint, which we never had before.
Senator Frey, just from Lane County, well, I practiced out of Lane County a lot, and then when I came and started practicing in Lane County, I was amazed at the delay
in setting cases for trial, because in Lane County we had to certify, as you know, that all all discovery has been completed. And if you want to talk about delay, the delay is occasioned in Lane County, for example, by the fact that I can't certify that all discovery is completed as long as defense firms are still sending me requests for production of documents. Quite frankly, I'll tell you, I've had some ridiculous ones. I had a lady with a whiplash, a neck injury, and they wanted her gynecologic records from 23 years before. I have no idea what for, but I think that's the delay that's occasioned.
Senator Waters?
Well, right on that point, this preliminary draft Professor Professor Malamud, I was speaking of, said that he found in Lane County. Do you remember his name? Is it Tillman or something like that?
I don't remember his name, Senator. I remember what came up.
But that in Lane County, there's a lot more delay than the other county he studied, was Coos County. In fact, a large difference. The more the delays had come from plaintiff's lawyers asking for delays. Now, when you have to certify in Lane County, that means that you send a document to the court saying we're all ready to go, right? I haven't practiced down there very much, but I had to do that once,
right.
I remember.
And the problem is if they send you a notice.
Let me finish my question.
Okay, I'm sorry.
The plaintiff and the defendant both, if you want to get the trial set, you've got to certify. But you don't have to go, like in Multnomah County, they keep calling the case, and you have to go and explain to the judge, both sides have to go and explain to the judge the Rule 4 hearing why they're not ready. Now, in Lane County, is there a reason why the plaintiff's lawyer would be more apt to be asking for the delay based on the certification program more than the defense lawyer?
Yeah, I can answer that, because what happens, Senator Wires, is you're running around trying to get all these documents, trying to complete all this discovery. You get one of these notices of dismissal that say that in 60 days, unless you can show good cause why your case shouldn't be kept on the docket, your case is going to be dismissed. That puts the burden on me as the plaintiff's lawyer. I can't file a certificate of readiness yet because I'm still out looking for documents that they want, although I would love to file a certificate of readiness. And so I've got to go into the court and respond to their notice of dismissal and keep my case alive, not the defense lawyer, because he's running me around. That's just because of their peculiar local rules that are in existence on Lane County, because the burden is always on the plaintiff's lawyer. So Lane County, statistics from Lane County on this issue of delay are absolutely meaningless because of the peculiar local rules.
So your local rule requires you, when your things are taking a long time, they require the plaintiff's lawyer to say why things aren't moving, and then you have to send in and ask for the delay?
That's right.
Whereas in Multnomah County, both lawyers go to Rule 4, and they both stand up and give their story.
That's right, and we do have an option out of it. Finally, you can move, but the burden is on the plaintiff's lawyer, and so your statistics just won't work in Lane County.
Senator Cohen's got a question here.
Well, now that we've gotten on this this issue, I had a little note here in my notes that I wanted to ask at another time, and I guess I'll throw it on the table now. Is it possible to reduce the number of motions filed, look at the discovery, take on some of that piece, and get that back into control? How much of that do we really need to do? I guess I'd like both sides of the lawyers to come up with some, to start thinking about that, because I'm going to start asking those questions more specifically as we get into this piece of the bill.
If I may respond to that, Charles Burt, again. Yes, there is a good deal that can be done in that area. I think that there's a report coming before the legislature from the rules people that make the court rules, suggesting a very significant modification in the Rule 21 motions and in so-called third-party practice. And I think they're suggesting that because they recognize during the last 2 years from the testimony that they took before their committee that this was being not only abused but was clogging up the system. And I think that will be before this legislature. If they, in fact, adopt the rules that these people suggest, it will curtail the backlog a great deal. In line with what Mr. Valour said, I recently had a head-on collision where a woman was badly injured, her facial injuries. She was a woman of about 45 years old. they asked for her medical records, in among other requests, back to and including her childhood. They wanted all medical records from the date of her birth, and they were very serious in it. Now, let me tell you what happens then. If I, as her lawyer, decide that she should not give them her records of the birth of her children, for example, or the records of her childhood diseases, and I refuse to do that, then the next step is we've got to go before a judge and get a court order saying that I do have to give that or I don't have to give that. And so there's one more step in the thing. It's going to delay the proceeding because we're, no matter how ridiculous the request is, if I don't comply with it, I get then a motion to compel. And the motion to compel then requires me to go before the judge, some judge, and explain to the judge why I don't think they should get it. Now, even if he agrees with me, you see, and they say, no, you don't get that, we've wasted 3 or 4 months in the proceeding just to decide whether I do or don't have to produce that record. On the other hand, if I produce the record, my client might be very much aggrieved at me if I produced records about her past history that have nothing to do with this lawsuit.
Senator Cohen, do you have another question?
No, I just want to put it on our agenda.
I think, we kind of got away from this prejudgment interest, but I think the point is well taken. And another bill that this committee has, as you know, examines the question of third-party practice. And I think Charlie may be thinking of the task force's recommendation,
yes,
in terms of revising third-party practice and making some substantial rule changes with the idea in mind of reducing the pretrial time involved in litigation. So that's going to definitely come up here if we can get through this bill at some point in time. Any other questions on where we are now?
Well, if we can solve the prison overcrowding problem, we might be able to get a case out in Multnomah County. Right now, you go up to call, and they send out the criminal cases, and then the judge says, we're all out of judges.
Well,
so that's another project we have this session.
Of course, I suppose they're claiming up there they need more judges then.
more jails.
Well, in any event, shall we move on from prejudgment interest? Do you have any comments on Section 10 at all?
Just that we recommend the adoption of Section 10. It's absolutely essential that I frankly was just dumbfounded that any lawyer enters into an oral agreement with his client on a contingency. That should never happen because it's not fair to the client and it's really not fair to the lawyer. Now, I admit perhaps you might forget to have one signed, but that's a grave oversight, and I do believe they should be in writing and plainly worded.
Okay. Now, all right. Does that take
that,
care of...
That does it.
That takes care of Section 10. Now, let's see. I'll tell you what here. I'm looking up here at the clock. We have. We still have three witnesses back in the audience who want to testify on sections 11 through 13, right? Okay. All right. Let's go ahead with sections.
Let's stay till 10 o'clock tonight.
Pardon?
I said I can stay till 10 o'clock tonight.
Oh. All right, let's go ahead with sections 11 and 12 then.
I want to speak, Charles Byrd, again briefly to section 11. I think you know without any question that it's been our position and still is that limits, no matter what they are, be it 100,000 on the state or 500,000 as proposed, we have demonstrated, I think, very clearly in the material that they have absolutely no effect on insurance availability or rates, and therefore they're not, by any stretch of the imagination, a means of reducing the rates, of premium rates, or of making it more available. I think the industry at this point has tucked its tail and admitted, and they have publicly, and we've given you the records, that hasn't worked and it won't work. So I'm not going to talk too much about that. When we go into, however, the wording of this bill, I think I'd be remiss if I didn't call to your attention that there is some language in this bill that's diametrically opposed to each other. In Section A, where you define economic damages, you provide for such things as care, domestic care, incurred for substitute domestic services, for example. That is called an economic loss. Then you go down to C, and you make a non-economic damage, the loss of comfort, care, and so forth, and all consortium cases as non-economic. There's a conflict in that. If I should be, if I had five children and my wife was killed, and I had to hire a housekeeper to take care of my five children, it would become an economic loss under the first definition as a substitute service for domestic use, and a non-economic loss for the loss of consortium. And so these things, I say this to you, that if you adopted these definitions, there would be almost nothing that I could not put an economic value on. So I think when we try to define economic versus non-economic, from a legal point of view, it just becomes a real rat's nest, because there's almost nothing that you list as so-called non-economic, other than pure mental suffering and that sort of thing, that you can, that you cannot put some sort of a value on.
Well, since those terms are not legal terms, but terms that were, have been promulgated by the insurance industry, maybe the insurance industry can give us a definition on that.
Well, they may like to do that, but you see, while they're insurance company terms, and they're promulgated by insurance adjusters and actuaries, actually, when they get into the courtroom, they're going to be dealt with as legal terms. And so whether they choose the words or not, once you put the stamp of approval on them by putting them into the law, then they're going to have to be interpreted not by the insurance company but by the courts. And I think it's a real problem. I certainly urge you not to waste the effort of putting an economic cap on if you think it's going to do something to reduce premiums and fees. I think, can demonstrate it's not. And if they have another reason for it, I'd like to have them tell us what it is.
Senator Cohen?
Well, I have concern about that whole redefinition of terms as well, and we did have Professor Vetri here, and he talked about monetary, non-monetary damages as part of court terminology and also pecuniary losses. And I guess I want, again, I'd like to return, if we get involved in this section at all, I certainly want to say that I'd like your comments about returning to those definitions, whether that's useful or not useful. I suppose your position is the whole section ought to be thrown out.
But
I guess I'd like your comment about whether that would help at any.
Our position is that this does not do anything to relieve the problem that we think we have. The problem of the insurance price and the availability is a marketing problem caused by their marketing practices, and it'll come on again regardless of what you do about limits, and I think that's demonstrated by every jurisdiction. So we think you shouldn't do it at all. But if you decide you want to do it, I think we have to say to you that you're walking into a real jungle when you start to define these terms. And unfortunately, I can't tell you, and I don't think any other lawyer can tell you, how the courts ultimately will decide what those mean. But it'll take many thousands of cases to do it. And it will have to be done case by case, because that's the only way we can work.
All right.
Senator Fry Lyle of Lur, I'd like to make just three comments on the idea of this type of cap thing. Number one, it is the ultimate in a regressive tax, because it places the burden on the people who are least able to afford the loss. That is the handful of people per year in Oregon who are the most seriously injured. And it's because it's just that small handful per year who are most seriously injured, it's going to place that burden on them. Secondly, I would note that this is a very discriminatory bill towards women, towards homemakers who do not have a job where we can go out and predict an economic loss, a huge economic loss. I had a case involving a 31-year-old mother who was killed by a tortfeasor, absolutely clear liability. No big, large economic loss whatsoever could be predicted
in that case under the terms as you now define them. However, she left a 3-year-old son and a 5-year-old son and a young father who was working 14 hours a day after having been laid off for several months in the log trucking business. It was a catastrophic, terrible loss. At this point in time, the loss to those two young children and to that husband under your legislation would be $500,000, the same as it would be for the death of any other housewife. I think it is terribly regressive and terribly discriminating. And from some experience that I have had in Canada, I can tell you that it's going to have absolutely the opposite effect. It's going to increase premiums rather than decrease premiums. And that is because it's going to significantly raise the cost of litigation to both plaintiff and defendant. And it's had that effect in California with the passage of MICRA. It's had that effect for many years in Canada. Because what it does on almost any case, it's going to become a battle of experts. And you're going to have to go out and spend $4,000 to $6,000 more on each side of that case in order to prove your economic damages, thereby raising the cost of the plaintiff, the cost of the defendant of each case by $8,000 to $12,000 total, because you're going to go out and you're going to hire a vocational expert to prove your economic damages, and that's going to cost you money. You're going to have a vocational study of the field done. That's going to cost you money. You're going to do it on both sides of the fence, both plaintiff and defendant. You're going to hire an economist, and those run $2,000 or $3,000 apiece in both areas, between vocational experts and economists. And so each and every case, you're going to have that. If you don't think I'm kidding, go up and talk to a lawyer from British Columbia. I happen to have the pleasure of trying a case with a barrister from British Columbia, and he told me what's happened. They've had caps for years in Canada. It has not affected insurance premiums. In the province of Ontario, insurance premiums last year went up 400% or something like that. It's in the packet that you have that we handed out. But in British Columbia, they have a cap. If for an arm, they give you $25,000, and for a leg, they give you something else, and things like that. They've had it for years. And so the way that the lawyers have to go about getting larger verdicts is to get into the economic damage picture. I was informed by that barrister that I tried a case with down here that there are firms of vocational counselors in Vancouver, Canada, and firms of actuaries, 60, 70 people in a firm, who do nothing but work for either plaintiff's lawyers or defense lawyers. And they go in and they testify, and it becomes a big battle of experts on economic damages, and that's going to be reflected in insurance premiums. This isn't going to solve a thing. It's not going to do anything for the insurance industry. It's going to hurt those few Oregon citizens who have very serious injuries. It's going to hurt the families of those people who do not have jobs because either they're a housewife or they're out of work at the time, and it's going to have the net effect of increasing insurance premiums to all of us. It's just a bad law. It's a bad law to consider. It's been proved wrong in Florida and every other state, and it's going to be wrong in the state of Oregon.
Bill Gaylord, Mr. Chairman, just a couple of comments by way of my 2 cents worth on the caps question. There's another aspect to this that I think needs to be considered. So long as you can imagine any cases that are subject to whatever kind of cap you might configure, then you have to ask yourself, first off, is it fair for those people to be singled out and to have, if you believe there's an impact on the insurance crisis, then to solve that crisis on the backs of those people? It won't solve that crisis, so I can't really say it'll do that. And secondly, recognize that the effect of this kind of legislation is much broader than just those cases that we can argue were worth more than that value. The process of litigation involves a lot of negotiation, a lot of anticipated compromise. It remains true that most of the substantial cases that are litigated are settled at some point in their life, and settlement is the most often outcome of cases that belong in the system and that result in the system working to the benefit of a person and compensating them. And settlement is perhaps the way that this kind of legislation is most adversely affecting, or has the most adverse effect on people. A case doesn't have to be worth excess of this cap to be badly damaged in its settlement potential. I'm going to have to try and go through trial on every case that I think is worth close to or anything over a cap like this, because the insurance company has no incentive to settle it. What have they got to lose by trying it if there's an arbitrary limit on what they can pay? We've seen this for years in the State Tort Claims Act situation. We've seen people whose claim cannot cost the defendant more than $100,000 in the state of Oregon situation, whose case is arguably worth 10 times that, but they can't settle it for even the 100 because the state says, we'll offer you $80,000, take it or leave it. We think there's a chance we'll get less than that, and what have we got to lose? The worst you can do to us is $100,000. That case has to go to trial where it should be settled. And wherever you put a limit, you do that, and you influence the system arbitrarily in that way, and very capriciously, I think, in many instances.
Mr. Lyle, you're talking about the person who doesn't work, and I guess that includes who isn't working at the time it happens, and I guess that includes retired people who aren't working. So in addition, if your argument is right about being unfair and discriminatory to house persons, which increasingly is becoming men as well as women, incidentally,